Good evening.
It would be really helpful if we could move into this central area. That would really help me out. Thank you. Okay, welcome. Can you put up your hand if you weren't here yesterday? If you were not here yesterday. Okay, a couple of folks. So I need to sort of rehearse some of the things I said yesterday. Can I thank those of you who have stopped me during the day and basically told me some of the stories that you have in working in this particular area? I'm always helped by people who understand the area that they work in and want to go forward in that particular area. So I've been really encouraged today by some of you who have spoken to me. That is also very helpful. Thank you. Okay, yesterday we explored a couple of words and looked at defining what each of them meant. They were culture, ethnic and ethnicity, and race. Let me take you through some of the definitions that I offer in working in this particular area. Culture is something that is external and that you choose, and it's basically the way we do things around here. England has been, and Britain has been, a multicultural area for decades, in fact, thousands of years. I don't know whether you know the migration line for the UK, but as far back as AD 43, different people have been coming into the UK and bringing their own cultures with them and going away with them. So to talk about multiculturalism is coming in the UK is a farce. We are a multicultural country. One of the things that we need to remember in this area, that no one culture in its entirety is superior or inferior to another culture. And that's where we get into trouble when we try to define what culture is. Secondly, ethnic and ethnicity is about genetics. All of us are multicultural in our heritage. We might not be able to trace our family tree all the way back, but I guarantee you that each of us are multi-ethnic in our heritage. And Acts 17, I think it's 25, 26 and 27, talks about from one ancestor he created all nations. And when we talk about race, there is one race, the human race, of which we all belong to different ethnic groups. That was basically what we tried to have a look at yesterday. And then I said that I tend to start from the end, from Revelation 7, in looking at where John sees a multitude of people worshipping God from every tribe, nation, and tongue. And if we as Christians are building the kingdom, that's what the kingdom looks like. And I start from there and work backwards in trying to understand how we as Christian work within the diversity that we have in the communities that we actually live in. I spend a lot of my time working with theological colleges in training ministers who are going to be working up and down the country in exploring the different cultures there are out there, especially in urban areas, and exploring all sorts of things in trying to understand the diverse communities that people actually belong to. Let me read you something before we explore what we think we understand by the term racism. John Sintamu, who's now the Bishop of Durham? No, he was the Bishop of Birmingham, he's now in Durham. Is that right? York. Okay. He assures me that this story is true, so I believe him. This is a letter written by a young man to his boss in South Africa. "Please, boss, please explain. When I am born, I am black. When I grow up, I am black. When I am ignorant, I am black. When I go out in the sun, I am black. When I am cold, I am black. When I am embarrassed, I am black. When I am jaundiced, I am black. And when I die, I am black. But you, when you are born, you are pink. When you grow up, you are white. When you are ignorant, you are green. When you go out in the sun, you are brown. When you are cold, you are blue. When you are embarrassed, you are red. When you are jaundiced, you are yellow. When you are ill, you are off color. When you die, you are purple. And you have the nerve to call me colored. Your loving garden boy, Sam. I thought from a child's perspective, it was an interesting way of looking at color. Some people get quite upset by that, but I think from a child's perspective in viewing this whole diversity and equality thing is quite an insight in understanding where we can get to. As adults, most of us don't talk about anything in this area at all because we feel as if we're treading on eggshells. And I wish that we would get past that and be able to talk the truth in love. Now, we've looked at three words. If there is one race, the human race, it makes a nonsense of the term racism. But the reality of the world that we live in is that most people don't understand what race is, and so racism is very real. I'd like you to get into small groups again and try and come up with a one-sentence definition for the word racism. Might be difficult, but let's have a try. You've got 5 minutes to do that. A sentence to define racism. You can begin to finish your conversations. Did any group come up with a definition for racism? Anybody? This is where you all get nervous now, isn't it? Anybody? Anybody going to offer? At least one.
We came up with the definition of power plus misjudged prejudice on grounds of ethnicity.
Okay. Thank you. Did you come up with one as well?
We said making a negative judgment about someone according to their ethnic origin, and very often you think that that's because they are inferior to you in some way. But that's a bit longer than a sentence.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? No? Did this group not come out with one?
One we came up with was discrimination based on perceived ethnicity. And then we talked about the whole idea of dominant, whether what was racism when, say, a black kid was being derogatory to a white kid in this country, something like that.
Thank you. Do you know, I knew you'd get nervous with me on this one. Because it's something that we don't talk about in any way, shape or form. Racism, I feel the term will change in the next 20 years or so. And I think it will end up being something like ethnic cleansing once we understand how we use language. Now, ethnic cleansing sounds quite harsh, but racism is quite harsh as well. But once we understand the terms that we're using and how we use them, people who have experienced racism can tell you what it feels like. Two people can walk into a room and one person can sense something that another can't. If you speak to some Scottish people who live in England, they can tell you what racism is. You can speak to some English people in Wales who can tell you what racism is. You can speak to people from minority ethnic groups who can tell you what racism is. The term or the equation that has been used for a long time is racism equals prejudice plus power. That is the term, the equation that has been used for years and years and years, and you can find that in most textbooks that talk about racism. I want to change the nuance on that a little bit. It might have been true in England and in some of the countries that racism is prejudice plus power. What I think it is now is prejudice plus perceived power. Because the economic difference that we have now to what we had 50 years ago is very different. And there's a perception of power that some people have that makes racism still work the way that it does. So it's prejudice plus perceived power, from my perspective. How does it work? It works on quite a few different levels. It works on a personal level, where you'll get one person's actions, attitudes, etc., to another individual, causes them to feel inferior or superior to another group of people. Racism is much, much more than a black-white issue. And some of us need to grasp hold of that. A guy called Francis Galton, who was a cousin of Darwin, started a movement called eugenics in the late 1800s. In 1907, there was an eugenics association. It was basically about cultivating a superior race positively, and you got rid of people who you felt who were subhuman or weren't quite intelligent enough, didn't have quite the right look, etc., etc., by either counseling or sterilizing them. And that went on years and years before the Nazis took it to another extreme, just in the Second World War. And that went on in the US, here in Britain, and other places in the world. And it was between people who looked alike, but one group perceived that another group was more intelligent than the other. And the way that they tried, and it was genetic engineering, basically, before we use the words. We have that label now, but that's exactly what they were doing. And so people were sterilized without knowing because they were perceived to be inferior to another group of people. So the term racism as we use it here in the UK is very, very different in that it should not be perceived as a black-white issue, and it is not. It is much, much bigger than that. I know that in India we have the caste system. In India, we have a group of people called the Dalits and Untouchables, and that's in their own culture that they perceive that. In the Caribbean and in some African country, it's called shadism. The lighter you are, the higher up the tree you are, the darker you are, etc., etc. So it has its roots in racism, but it's expressed very differently in all sorts of cultures. Structural racism, the composition and organization of an institution. Institutional racism was brought to light with the McPherson Report. Have any of you ever read it? Yeah? That was the first time the sort of term actually hit us in the UK. And you would think that the police is the only institution that we have in the whole of the UK, because they're the only ones who get shot at with this particular term. Institutional racism, the procedures, rules and practices of an institution that causes only one particular group of people to move up the ladder and another group not to. Cultural racism, the imposition of the values, ideas and concepts of one culture onto another. And yesterday I was talking about, from a church perspective or any sort of youth group perspective, you may have a multicultural youth group or a multicultural church, but what goes on from the front is monocultural because they're subscribed to a particular culture. Therefore, people who come sometimes have to be who they are not to fit in. And you can watch how that manifests itself, especially in youth groups. Dress a certain way, look a certain way, talk a certain way. You fit in better than if you choose not to. And we need to be careful if we have this picture of multiculturalism, diversity and equality looking like Revelation 7, where people express themselves in their own language, tribe, nation and tongue, and feel at ease to do that. Why is it then, in a multicultural society here in the UK, do we only choose to worship God in our churches in one particular language when we have the richness of lots of other languages that are with us that we could learn from? And I have learned that there are some words in different cultures that have, say, for instance, love in the UK, you have one word that means love. In other cultures, you have several words that mean a different kind of love that we can learn from. Do you see what I mean? And understand one another. Culture-wise, I know that I have a worldview. Although I was born here in the UK, I know that I have a worldview that is from an African-centric perspective as well as a Western perspective. And sometimes I use both if I want to see things clearly. And those voices in our churches that perhaps don't speak English as well as we do may see things a little clearer because of where they come from, but they are never given a voice to actually do that. And there are lots of things that we can do culturally within our churches to actually change that. Discrimination is active. It can be a deliberate act. It can be passive in that it's a deliberate act, decision not to act. And it can be also unintentional, a failure to perceive the need to act. I've got an exercise that I'd like you to have a look at in how some people or how you might discover what racism may look like. I often, when I'm teaching, go into situations where I am told that racism doesn't exist. I guarantee you that in leaving any seminar where people talk about racism, you will recognize it when you see it. You then have the choice to say something or not. In the jokes that people tell, the way you listen to things and the way that you see things, you then either choose not to say anything or be a part of what is going on. Evil exists, and I have to tell you that racism is a sin, and it's an evil, and it exists because good people do nothing, as far as I'm concerned. That's the way it exists. And I am upset sometimes with the church because we allow it, because we stand back and say nothing. And I get terribly, terribly upset from a Christian perspective, that we do that day in, day out, without actually recognise what it is that we're a part of. Okay, this is a scenario, that the beginning of it is a scenario in an imaginary China. On the back, there are some questions. Now, we're not going to be able to answer all the questions at all, but I'd like you to read the scenario in your groups. I'd like one person to read the scenario to the others, and then I'd like you to answer one question at the back. One question at the back, and then we'll see how we get on from there. Recognize the scenario. Put up your hand if you recognize the scenario. Okay, quite a few of you. Okay. Did you find any easy answers to those questions? That's exactly why I want you to take it away. Normally, I can use this and it lasts for a whole day, because then I ask people to come up with a plan of how, as a community, they would actually live in this imaginary China and what is the future for them and their children. But the reality of it is that this is a lived experience here in the UK. And some of the voices of people who are going through this on a daily basis are never heard in the very churches where we sit and worship with one another. So we don't hear the pain and understand the struggles that they're actually working through on a day-to-day basis. When they come to church on a Sunday, they have a smile on their faces. My parents have had to work through some of this, as I know that many other parents have had to work through it. And there are some people in this room who will have to work through it for their children as well. I'll invite a couple of you to come up and to express some of the sentiments and things that were actually said in your group. Does somebody want to come from this particular group here?
Hi, we were looking at question three, or at least that's where we started at, the idea of how you would build better relationships with your Chinese neighbours. And so the first suggestion was to invite people round your Chinese neighbours. And then we raised the question of, well, what would you offer them? Would you offer them Chinese food and Chinese drinks, or do you offer them British drinks and British food, which might possibly alienate them, but then they might laugh at you if you try and pretend to cook Chinese stuff. And so we've kind of risen that sort of question and the need to retain your own culture and your own identity so you don't just lose it and become Chinese. Talked about the idea of learning the language and developing the language, or at least enough to say greetings as you walk out the door in the morning, that sort of thing. And in this case, we talk about the children a lot and possibly using the children as a way in and the need to find a connection and some way of relating, something that you both had in common, and that might be a starting point for conversation or at least connection.
Okay, thank you. Can I invite you to come up as well, please?
I suppose for me this is much more personal, and the scenario sort of very much reflects how we were brought up in Britain. My parents were very much marginalised. They came from a professional background abroad but couldn't practice that in this culture. And we were taught to have a strong belief about who we were and what we wanted to achieve. So despite what my school would say about the role that I should adopt, my parents are quite clear that we should grow and sort of progress in a way that was sort of almost sort of enlightening and encouraging to each other as a family. And so the expectations at school were that I would go into a shop or something like that and not into the profession that I'm currently in at the moment. So.
Excellent. I caught a little bit of your story as I walked past, which reflects my own. I left school in 1976 and I was told to go into some sort of nursing thing. And I went and did my nursery nurse qualification that took me 2 years. I've never used it. Never, ever used it, because that's not where my calling was. Do you know? And God had other plans for me, and now I run my own business. But there was that pressure there to be. The other thing I wanted to say was that I grew up in a Pentecostal church, the New Testament Church of God. And some of those ministers, if you sat and listened to their story, you would weep. Some of them are in their 60s and 70s who have never been able to articulate their pain in a wider space other than in their church setting. So my generation were banned from going to other churches because my parents experienced the pain firsthand, wanted to protect me, so banned me from going to any other churches. And so you have a generation of minority ethnic people here in the UK who've never experienced the wider church family other than the ones that they're in. And believe me, there's a lot of us who have never crossed the line in understanding the wider church family that we belong to. So how is that building the kingdom is the question I ask. But those forefathers who had to set up their own churches because of the pain and rejection that they felt wanted to protect my peer group. And so a generation have grown up not knowing their fellow brothers and sisters and understanding the theology that they have in Christendom. Anybody else want to come and use the mic in telling us what they explored in their group or some of the solutions they may have come up with in their group? Anybody? Did you find it an easy exercise? No. But do you recognise that there are people who live next door to you and people you sit next door to in church who experience this on a daily basis? I want you to take it home and think about it. It's harsh, but it's very true. And you will not understand racism from a textbook. It's about people, and it's about the language that we use and the things that we do that alienate or make one group of people feel inferior to another group of people. We haven't got a lot of time left. Can I throw this open now for some questions? There's one thing I need to clarify yesterday. A couple of you asked me about the census form and how is it you can't monitor people and get a sense of what is going on. I have no problems with census forms. My only problem is to describe people in stark terms as black and white, I feel is unhelpful. I would prefer a census form that says, one, what is your nationality? Two, what is your ethnic descent? Period. Then people can self-define themselves and understand their nationality. And I think if you work for any kind of group of people who needs statistics on who's in the country, that will give you enough. Because people self-define themselves, and you could put a criteria in. Can you self-define yourself from your grandparents to your generation? And that will give you clear data of defining who people are. It won't tell you what color they are, but it will tell you their background. Okay? And I think that's enough, as far as I'm concerned.
I was going to ask you why you chose the text from Revelation rather than from Pentecost, when everybody heard the gospel in their own language, which links very nicely to Hebrews, where the writer says, in times past, God spoke to our ancestors.
I specifically chose the term, scriptures in Revelation, because it is looking to the new kingdom. John saw something that will happen. And all of us in Christendom are building the kingdom. That's what we talk about. We're building the kingdom. But sometimes we're building something, we have no idea what it looks like. It's about justice, it's about the poor, etc., etc., but it's also about equality and diversity. And some of us have just totally missed that completely. So, yes, I could use that, but I've started at the end, and I'm working backwards. I sat in church for years. I was this close to becoming a Rastafarian when I was 18 in the late 1970s, this close. And the reason was because I thought the Bible had nothing to say about me as a person who... Let me put it another way. The Bible was open to me as if everybody in the Bible had blonde hair, blue eyes. And the Bible was about that particular group of people. So I grew up thinking that there was nothing in me that could resonate with what the people who were going in their culture, etc., etc. Having now studied theology, I understand that. But sometimes we open the Bible and you'd think it was purely European people who were in the Bible. Purely. Do you know what I mean? And now we think we're quite hip when we talk about the term black theology. There's no such thing as black theology. There's an African-centric perspective on theology, as there is a European perspective on theology. But theology can be viewed from a multitude of different perspectives. And once we start classifying it as black and white, again, it doesn't help the debate. And my friend Robert Beckford is on site, and he'd kill me for saying that. Do you know what I mean? But he and I argue about it all the time. I prefer it to be called theology from an African-centric perspective, as there is theology from a European-centric perspective. It's the way we use words that help one group of people always to feel inferior or superior to another group of people that we keep stumbling on all the time. Any other questions? No? Okay. Do any of you know anything about Racial Justice Sunday? Do you know that such a Sunday exists? Okay, the second Sunday in September is Racial Justice Sunday. They are selling some packs on the bookstore out there. A group of us that work with Church's Commission for Racial Justice have been right in the pack for years. It's full of very helpful information that you can bring to your church on that special Sunday, but information that you can also use on other Sundays in your church as well. Very helpful. Please do pick up a pack. They're something like £2 or £3. If there aren't any more in there, get hold of Churches Together in Britain and Ireland, or your denominational office should be able to point you in the right direction. I know the Methodists take them. I know the Baptists take them. URC very much does. Church of England does, etc., etc. So if you want that pack, you'll find lots of information, maybe about some of the stuff that I've talked about in there as well. I also do training, if any of you are interested in that and want to talk to me about that later on. What was the other thing that I needed to do? I need to read you this. I find this very helpful in understanding who I am and what it is that I've been called to do. I believe that I've been given special grace in this particular area of racial justice. I've been doing this kind of stuff for the last 20-odd years. And sometimes people ask me if I don't get fed up at how slow we're actually going. And sometimes I do, but I feel that this is what I'm called to do, and I just need to continue to get on with what I get on with. Nelson Mandela is somebody who really inspires me. He has never professed in public that he has a personal faith, but I know that he was brought up in school in the Methodist denomination. Somebody said that he once said this, but I now know that he didn't. A lady called, her name is Marianne Williamson, wrote these words that I find inspirational in doing the work that I do. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God, and your playing small will not serve the world. There is nothing enlightening about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. You are born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in every one. As you let your light shine, you unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As you are liberated from your own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Thank you for coming to the seminar. I hope that I've helped to enlighten some of you in some of these areas. Please do feel free to ask me any questions, or I'm usually hang around at the Christian Socialist Movement stand. I happen to be chair of that, and I decided that some things around diversity and equality need to be challenged by whichever government we have there, so that gives me another route in actually talking about some of these things. But I challenge you in understanding, if you understand what's going on in our world, you can make a difference. Sometimes I'd like to ask God why there is racism, pain, homelessness, etc. in our world. Sometimes I'd like to pray and ask him why he doesn't do something about it. The reality is I don't pray it because he might ask me what I'm doing about it. And each of us have a responsibility in the areas where we do actually see what's going wrong around us to stand up and to be counted. Thank you very much indeed.